Did you know that there is a common thread between persistent pain and depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress? Join the Science of Exercise and Pain for a one-hour online comprehensive course of 40-plus peer-reviewed journals, assessments, and treatment on how to manage persistent pain. This course is The Marriage of Mental Health and Pain at thescienceofexerciseandpain.teachable.com.
Kimberly here. May to every day. What is it? May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Every day is our commitment year-round to continue the conversation as providers and the public on mental health awareness. The deaths of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain brought to the forefront in the public mental health. Many of you, as well as I, have individuals in our circles struggling with survivorship of suicide. There are many ways that each of us can work to improve mental health within ourselves as well as others. Here are three tools. One, get linked to a medical provider for whatever medical facility you are connected with. These providers typically are going to be psychiatrists, psychologists, sometimes nurse practitioners, sometimes advanced practice social workers. Two, get involved in some sort of supportive group. Cognitive behavioral therapy offers group therapy, as well as other support groups offered through organizations such as NAMI. Three, get involved in your community. Social isolation is one of the highest risk factors regarding mental health and suicide risk. By becoming socially engaged in your community, whether it is your church, a gardening group, or an exercise group, each of these strategies help to combat isolation and risk factors with mental health and suicide risk. Exercise is one of the most effective ways to increase mood regarding depression and anxiety in peer-reviewed studies. This is May to every day. It is our commitment as providers and the public to mental health awareness. Thank you. Kimberly here. May to every day. What is it? May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Every day is our commitment year-round to continue the conversation as providers and the public on mental health awareness. The deaths of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain brought to the forefront in the public mental health. Many of you, as well as I, have individuals in our circles struggling with survivorship of suicide. There are many ways that each of us can work to improve mental health within ourselves as well as others. Here are three tools. One, get linked to a medical provider for whatever medical facility you are connected with. These providers typically are going to be psychiatrists, psychologists, sometimes nurse practitioners, sometimes advanced practice social workers. Two, get involved in some sort of supportive group. Cognitive behavioral therapy offers group therapy, as well as other support groups offered through organizations such as NAMI. Three, get involved in your community. Social isolation is one of the highest risk factors regarding mental health and suicide risk. By becoming socially engaged in your community, whether it is your church, a gardening group, or an exercise group, each of these strategies help to combat isolation and risk factors with mental health and suicide risk. Exercise is one of the most effective ways to increase mood regarding depression and anxiety in peer-reviewed studies. This is May to every day. It is our commitment as providers and the public to mental health awareness. Thank you. Welcome to The Science of Exercise and Pain with Kimberly, a listener-supported podcast at Anchor FM. Follow the link in the show notes to support this program and find out more about today's topic of The Science of Exercise and Pain. Thank you for your support. So what is the science of exercise and pain? I'm going to share that with you today. But first, a little bit about myself, the host and content creator. For the past 13 years, I have been trusted to orthopedic surgeons, rheumatologists, primary care, and private clients for growth. My educational background includes a Master's of Science in Occupational Therapy, Bachelor's of Science in Exercise Science, and Facilitator Training from St. Catharines University in Evidence-Based Practice and Problem-Based Learning. I have been requested to provide live education and facilitation of healthcare content to interdisciplinary teams of therapists, physicians, nurses, and students. I am now leveraging that experience with technology to curate digital, relevant healthcare content, including peer-reviewed journal articles, books, and online education for you, the public, healthcare providers, researchers in academia, and health administrators to improve care quality. The science of exercise and pain began in the year 2005. It was my first year as an occupational therapist. Fresh out of OT school and internships in Minneapolis, I was treating orthopedic and neuro patients. One thing I noticed with many of the patients I was working with was a lot of them were in pain. This was not the typical, I bumped my funny bone pain. It was something more. Their pain did not follow the typical pain patterns we learned about in OT school, such as peripheral nerve patterns or dermatomal patterns. These patients did not in many cases have orthopedic injuries, and yet were still having life-altering pain. I talked to a mentor at that time about this, and I questioned, what was going on with these patients? I don't think that all of these patients are malingering. I think there's something genuinely going on. What's the deal? My mentor replied, some of these patients, you may never know what their story is and why they're in pain. They are just in pain, and our job is to treat the symptoms. Well, me being a logical person and investigator, I thought to myself, well, I don't know if that answer really works for me. I want to research a little bit more so I can find more ways to improve patients' lives. And so I continued on in my career, working for another outpatient rehabilitation group, as well as an organization that worked with work injuries, and from there worked with orthopedic and plastic surgeons. With all of those different organizations, I was seeing the same patterns, different focuses and organizations, but still seeing patients having pain, despite having all sorts of rehabilitative care, all sorts of surgeries, they were still coming back painful. During this time, I was introduced to some literature by one of my clinic managers who is now retired. He was born in the United Kingdom and worked for the McKinsey Institute in Australia before coming to the United States. He introduced me to the literature for Mosley and Butler. It was there that I learned about phantom limb pain, visual feedback rehabilitation, and mirror therapy. I started to learn a lot about the neuroscience of pain. Things began to turn the corner. I was for once beginning to truly understand pain. Over this last decade, I have been seeing more and more in interdisciplinary literature, especially psychology, the connections of pain and complex histories of trauma, abuse of various sorts, and pain actually being mediated from the brain. It was almost as if a memory of the physical trauma, emotional, sexual, or spiritual trauma of an individual experienced was being manifested in the body, not as a depression, but actually as a physical pain. If you look at the literature that talks about fibromyalgia or other chronic musculoskeletal conditions, these are common things you will find. And so, I have continued to work in my career as an occupational therapist, and I continue to be passionate about researching and finding more ways to improve the lives of clients and understanding pain. I will leave links in the show notes about the profession of occupational therapy and the upcoming Science of Exercise and Pain online education series. If you would like to learn more about the science of exercise and pain, send inquiries to healthcare.substance@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to The Science of Exercise and Pain with Kimberly, a listener-supported podcast on Anchor FM.
Welcome to The Science of Exercise and Pain with Kimberly, a listener-supported podcast at Anchor FM. Follow the link in the show notes to support this program and find out more about today's topic of clinical education, how to bring your new initiatives, your new education, and your new research to your clinical providers. Thank you for your support. So clinicians are busy people. They don't have a lot of time to dig into the research, so they really rely upon their peer clinical educators to keep them up to speed. In my years, 13, as a practitioner and clinical educators in rehab, orthopedic, and primary care teams, these are two things that I've learned and you also should know. One, narrow down your information so that it's in small bits, easy to understand, and easy to apply. Two, clinicians like to receive their information from their clinical educators or clinical peers, individuals that they respect and consider to be their peers. Clinicians tend to feel a certain kind of way about non-providers bringing initiatives, education, and research that's not been vetted or supported by their clinical peers. So it's in your best interest and best practice to include clinicians. That's really it. This is what you can do to bring your new initiatives, your new education, and your new research to your clinical providers. This is The Science of Exercise and Pain with Kimberly, a listener-supported podcast at Anchor FM. Follow the link in the show notes to support this program and find out more about the science of exercise and pain. Thank you for your support. Welcome to The Science of Exercise and Pain with Kimberly, a listener-supported podcast at Anchor FM. Follow the link in the show notes to support this program and to learn more about today's topic of performance and perception, colorblindism, and health disparities. Thank you for your support. So in the August 2018 Journal of Ethnic Disparities, Dr. Cunningham from the University of Minnesota published an amazing article looking at this philosophy called colorblindism. There's a team of individuals who were mostly, if not all, non-Hispanic white, dedicated and with interest in health equity. In this particular study, Dr. Cunningham looked at thoughts, attitudes, and opinions with these particular health individuals, health clinicians, and what were the contributing factors to health disparities. Overwhelmingly, the participants found that, or at least suggested that, socioeconomics, patient culture, and patient choice were the factors related to health disparities. Now, these particular thoughts, attitudes, and opinions contradict a number of research studies across different specialties in healthcare and medicine that have found that it's actually race itself to be the factor, adjusted for covariance, socioeconomics, and a number of other factors. So my thought to you and question to you is, what do you think? Is colorblindism a factor within your team? I learned about colorblindism actually earlier this year from a number of peers who are non-Hispanic white who grew up in different communities across the United States. It was a common teaching method or philosophy taught in middle schools, in churches, in community centers, in clubs, emphasizing that
all Americans, regardless of ethnicity, are treated the same. Now, this philosophy is very different than many philosophies and lived experiences of individuals of color, and specifically Black. So I'd like to know your thoughts. How is colorblindism affecting performance versus the perception of performance? This is the Science of Exercise and Pain with Kimberly, a listener-supported podcast at Anchor FM. Thank you for your support.